More than a million of us vaccinated here in the Commonwealth are now eligible to get a booster. That's now that the FDA and the CDC allow certain groups to boost, but some, even on the scientific panels that endorsed boosters, question if they're necessary. Now, that comes as the FDA meets formally today to weigh the benefits and risks of a first dose of Pfizer's vaccine for children age 5 through 11. Halloween's just around the corner. Kids' trick-or-treating is on. And so are the masks. Today, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Jeff Riley extended the school mask requirement until at least January 15th. Now, those schools that can achieve vaccination among students and staff of above 80% can still seek a waiver for that. For the latest on masks, boosters, kids' vaccines, even plus versions of the Delta variant, we turn to Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Doron, thanks for joining us.
It's such a pleasure.
So we have many questions, and I want to start with kids' vaccines. The FDA panel is meeting today. This is Pfizer for kids 5 through 11. What are they weighing here? How effective is the vaccine for kids, and how necessary is it considering any risks?
Yeah, they are having a robust discussion as we speak. I've been watching it all day. They're really focusing, as we knew they would, on the question of risk benefit. It's a tricky question. Children do not have as high a risk of severe complications from COVID-19 as adults, but they do have a risk. And severe COVID-19 is not the only risk. Obviously, we know about long COVID. We know about delayed complications like the multi-system inflammatory syndrome. And so all of that is being taken into account and weighed against the risk of myocarditis, heart inflammation that we know can occur after mRNA vaccination. But we don't know how often in this age group because no study could be large enough to be able to really assess that numerically.
Okay, so if that's the question and no study can really assess it, then how do they make a decision today?
So they're looking at essentially mathematical models. They've looked at, the FDA has developed six different risk-benefit scenarios using different assumptions. So different assumptions about how effective the vaccine might be, different assumptions about how prevalent the infection is in the community, different assumptions about how much myocarditis you might see. And so using those different models, all but one, five out of the six, showed that the risk-benefit analysis favors vaccinating over keeping people unvaccinated and having them take their chances with the virus.
Okay, last thing on this. Any reason to believe that the FDA advisory panel will not recommend Pfizer vaccinations for kids 5 through 11?
Well, the advisory panel is an external advisory group. And so, you know, the fact that the FDA's analysis suggests a benefit does not mean that the advisory panel will vote accordingly. So, you know, I never say never, or I never say always. I think that they will vote in favor of emergency use authorization. I'm not sure it will be unanimous based on the discussions I'm hearing right now. There's some concern that perhaps not every child between the ages of 5 and 11 should be vaccinated. And so they're just starting to talk a little bit right now about, you know, the issue of the fact that up to 40% of children may have prior infection, and how might that play into the risk-benefit analysis, which was actually not in the model.
So especially if it's not unanimous, how do you advise families or counsel families on thinking through the risks for themselves and their kids?
You know, it wasn't unanimous the first time, actually, when Pfizer was initially approved in December. But what I have been saying, and, you know, obviously, at the end of today's meeting, and then after the ACIP, the Advisory Council to the CDC, will meet on November 2nd and November 3rd. And I plan to listen to every word. And that's, those discussions are what I use to have my conversations with people. And basically to say that, you know, a lot of really smart people looked at every shred of data that exists, every shred, and did their best in an unbiased manner to weigh the risks against the benefits, and concluded that the benefits outweigh the risks.
All right. CDC does not meet, or that advisory panel doesn't meet till next week. Halloween's this weekend. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says it's okay. Go trick-or-treating. What is your message to families?
Absolutely. Go trick-or-treating. Outside, we know so much more. I was not an absolutist about this a year ago today, but I am now. Outside is so safe. So, even for unvaccinated people.
So can I get a chuckle and declare that Dr. Shira Doron is an absolutist on pro trick-or-treating?
Yes.
Outstanding. Okay, I do want to stay with kids on this, and I want to talk about a different kind of masks. I mean, kids will be wearing all kinds of masks trick-or-treating outdoors, but I'm thinking about school. The decision by DESE today to extend the mask mandate until at least January 15th. Also, before the break, I was talking to Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker. We both were part of a debate last night with the two mayor candidates. When asked sort of what threshold would you take masks off this year in schools, they both said masks stay on this year, even if a school reaches 80% vaccination, which is currently the DESE guidance. So what's the science there? And in your view, when should masks come off for kids, especially in schools?
Ooh, it's such a tough one because no one's in the middle on this anymore. You know, people are either really strong proponents of masks in school and often without really being able to name what their off-ramp is. And I really like to challenge people when they say, you know, no, not 80% or not whatever other threshold has been suggested, to say, well, what is, you know, I think that most people would not say that children should wear masks in school forever. I think that we can, or at least we should acknowledge that it does impact the educational experience differently for different people. And some kids really embrace masks, but for the younger learners, for language, for social development, for people who have anxiety issues, for people who have hearing impairment, for many children, it's difficult. And we do need to talk about when it should end. And you can absolutely, I welcome conversation and argument and debate about what that threshold could be, because there is no right answer. Before we can argue, though, about the threshold, I think we have to agree on the goal. Why are we wearing masks in school? Why are we doing the things we're doing? And last year, I think we had an agreement. Last year, we knew that we couldn't prevent every case of COVID from entering the building, but we wanted to prevent every person-to-person transmission. This year, what are we trying to prevent? I think my personal opinion is that we do not need to, nor should we be trying to prevent every person-to-person transmission, because vulnerable people have been given the opportunity to be vaccinated, i.e. adults and older teens, younger people are protected by youth. So then you can talk about vaccination rates. You can talk about case rates in the community. Some people would rather use hospitalization rates because cases have been decoupled from hospitalization. But we need to name a threshold. And I think that the 80% vaccination threshold for the older students or the older, you know, the high schools and middle schools is as good as any of a starting point. I'd like to see cases in the community stable or declining, obviously not on an upswing if a school is to remove its mask mandate. But I think we need to try, and Hopkinton did announce that they were going to do a 3-week trial without masks because they are above 80%. I think that's exactly the way to go.
Okay. So last question on this, briefly, because I have several booster questions I want to make sure we get to. Are we doing a bad job with public health messaging? You're saying we don't even know what the goal is here.
That's right. I think, you know, I won't say bad job, but I think there's so much opportunity here for better public health messaging. So what are we trying to achieve? Let's get on the same page about that. Celebrate that children do have a lower risk of severe disease. Celebrate that in Massachusetts, unlike the rest of the country, now we have so much anxiety about this school situation. That's why we're so polarized. And the anxiety that really ramped up in August and September came from what we were seeing in the rest of the country, which was quite horrific. The numbers of children getting sick and ending up in the hospital. We haven't celebrated or even messaged that we didn't see that in Massachusetts. we didn't see an increase in pediatric hospitalization in Massachusetts. And there's no reason to sweep that under the rug. It's great news.
All right. I do want to move on to boosters for a second. So first, quick rundown, who currently qualifies for a booster?
Okay. So if you received J&J, there are no limitations. Anyone who's an adult, J&J is only approved for people over 18, you may have a booster as long as it has been 2 months since your J&J vaccination. If you're a Pfizer or Moderna recipient, it needs to be 6 months since your initial series, your second dose. But then there are some limitations to who is eligible. The CDC says that you should be vaccinated if you are over 65, if you're over 18 and live in a long-term care facility, or if you are between 50 and 64 and have at least one underlying medical problem that is a risk factor for severe COVID-19. But they also say that you may, if you wish, be vaccinated if you're between 18 and 49 and have at least one medical condition, or if you're at higher risk for COVID due to institutional or occupational setting.
Okay, that's helpful. So I do want to quickly talk about the Moderna booster. Now that mixing and matching is also allowed, Moderna is approved as a half dose for a booster. So if one received J&J as your first dose, and now you're getting a booster, you will get a half Moderna dose. Is that so? The approval of mixing and matching was based on research that showed, tremendous impact with a Moderna booster as well as a Pfizer. But Moderna is this half dose. Did the research look at a half dose of Moderna? And what does it mean if you get boosted with Moderna and it's a half dose?
Right. The research did not. And so we're really operating with a relative, absence of information here. The research on the mix and match approach didn't tell us anything about effectiveness. It was just antibody levels. And so what it tells us is that mixing and matching is safe, at least in the small study. And it tells us that there are some differences in how much boost you get to your antibody levels with different vaccines. But no, it doesn't tell you what 50 micrograms of Moderna would have done as opposed to 100 micrograms. And it is not at all powered to make comparisons between the different combinations. So, people have been asking me, if I got Pfizer, should I now get boosted with Moderna and vice versa? I cannot answer that question. And I think that's overthinking it a little bit. I think if there is a compelling reason for you to get something different than what you originally got, then this study shows that it surely works and is almost definitely safe. But I wouldn't go, trying to come up with the optimal combination because I don't think we have the data to inform that.
All right. That's Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Very helpful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.